I'm Daryl, compulsive overeater. And steps 8 and 9. We get used to putting the two steps together as though they're one step, but they're really not. They're two separate steps. And even the Big Book tends to do that too. I think that it says we have a list on page 76. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. My list didn't have just those people on there. I think I had three lists probably. I had those people that fit that criteria, that they were people that I was willing to make amends to. It was just a matter of getting around to doing it, but I was working on it. And then I had the ones that I was having trouble becoming willing, but I was working on that and making some progress and moving towards it. In fact, on that list were some of my family members, my brother and my sister and my dad. And then I had the list that I was not willing to make and the amends to. And that was my mom. She was a short list, but she was the one. And I was asking, it tells us that when we're not willing to, we should ask, and I was asking, and I wasn't getting any closer. I was getting closer with my brother. In fact, I had made a provisional amends to him, and we were over at his house, and I just told him, hey, I'm going to have a sit down and talk to you, maybe in a couple of weeks, and so he said, yeah, no problem, anytime. And so I was pretty much getting ready there, but an interesting thing happened. I had to turn the clock back a few months, and I came to this meeting, this step study. And in those days, it was up in the canyon up at the end of Glendora Avenue, at a church up there. And I remember walking, or I was in the sitting in there, and this guy came walking in late to the meeting, and he looked and he had a chair next to me, and he came over and he sat next to me, and he looked familiar, and I was trying to figure out, where do I know this guy? And then it dawned on me that he was the assistant pastor at my brother's parish. And so I whispered to him, "Hi, Father," and he goes, "Shh." And I said, "Okay." So afterwards, I talked to him. He said, "I don't want anybody to know I'm a priest." He says, "Then they won't. They'll stop cussing at the meetings." And I said, "Okay, yeah, your secret's safe with me." And so then, fast forward, so probably about 3 months go by, and I'm in this process, and I'm making some of my amends, especially my business amends. I'm making those pretty regularly. And then I get a call one night from a fraternity brother of mine, and I hadn't seen this guy in 20 years. And he calls me at home, and he says, "Hey, I have a piece of property you might be interested in." And I said, "I'm not interested in any property, Don." And he says, and he gave me the address. I said, "Hey, that's the house I grew up in." And he said, "I figured it probably was." So he says, "It's vacant. I have it on the market, and I'm showing it tomorrow to a prospective buyer. If you want to come by, it's you can help yourself and go through the house if you wish." And I've been in a program long enough to know that when God gets that direct, you're supposed to pay attention, because that was just too incredible a coincidence. And so I said, "Okay, I will be there," even though I was scared to. And so I show up the next day, and sure enough, and he's out on the front lawn, and he's talking to the lady that's the prospective buyer, and he says, "Go on, just you can go on through it. So the house is vacant." And so I walked in, and the house was amazingly unchanged, that it was pretty much just the way that I remembered it. And I went, the only thing that had been remodeled was the kitchen. and but everything else was just pretty much the way that it was. And I went into the bedroom that was belonged to my brother and myself, and it had built-in drawers under the closet. And I thought to myself, those drawers always stuck. I wonder if they still stick. And I pulled one open, and inside were the drips of paint when it was the color of the room when my brother and I had it, and then the pink when my sister was born, and they converted that to her room. And and the drawers did stick, and but it was it got me to open those drawers and just get reminded of that. And then there was a closet that I thought was going to remind me of the places that I hid sometimes to overeat. When I thought about the closet, that's not what I thought about. I thought about the atomic bomb ring that I got from the Lone Ranger. I had sent 50 cents in and a couple of box tops, and it finally came, and it said that this atomic bomb ring, that if you look through this little tiny lens, that you'd be able to see atoms shooting through the and I said, oh boy, so I was just waiting to get hold of this thing, and I got it, and I sat in that closet for 2 hours, and I never saw an atom, still haven't. And so anyway, so it didn't work, but that's what I remembered. And then I went back to the room that belonged to my brother and myself, and then I went out into the yard and down into the patio my dad had built, and everything was amazingly the same. There was the apricot tree that I don't know if you've ever binged on apricots, but that tree was a good one for that. And so that was all good memories. And so I remember standing there in the back bedroom with that belonged to my brother and myself, and just having this little dialogue with God, and basically telling him, "Hey, I don't know why you had me come here today, but I've got to go now." And so anyways, and I guess basically thanks for the memories. And so I go out to the front part of the house, and my friend is inside the house now talking to the lady, and the alarm on the oven on the in the kitchen starts going off, and it's just making this ding ding ding, and I told him, and I guess he was annoying him, and so I said, "Don, I'll turn off that alarm, and then I've got to go, but I'll give you a call later. Thank you." And so I go into the kitchen to turn off the alarm on the oven, and the house was bare. There were no pictures on the walls or anything, but there was this plaque on the wall in the kitchen, and it says, any woman can be a mother, but it takes a special person to be a mom." And I was so convicted in that moment. I had this image of this house being a torture chamber, and she was the lead torture person. And here I'd gone through this house. I'd been there for 45 minutes, and I didn't have one bad memory. And I went to the park, which is only a half a block away. And I sat at one of the picnic tables there, and I wrote out my amends. And I was able to make those amends a little bit later, but I was able to make those amends. So I became willing. My step eight happened at that moment. So that's the first part of the story. The second part of the story is I tell my sister about that I went through the house. And she calls my brother, who was up in Stanford. He was up there getting a check for, he was in remission from a cancer that he had been fighting. But it looked like he was going to win that battle. And so she called him, and then he called me. And we talked for the nicest conversation for about 45 minutes. And it was and he wanted to know all about the house. And I told him, he said, "Do you think that I could go through it?" And I said, "Hey, when you get back down here, if it's still on the market and my friend has it, I know we can." And so anyway, and it was we just had a really nice visit. Early the next morning, I get a call from his wife, and she said that that he's just collapsed, and that the ambulance is on the way, and they're going to take him to the Stanford Medical Center. And I called my secretary, and I said, and this is before cell phones, so I was still at home. And I called my secretary and told her to get me on the next flight that she could up to San Jose, which I think was the closest airport. And so I went straight to the airport, and then I called her, and she gave me the details for the flight that she had gotten me on. And as God would have it, that the only place I had open was a first class. It was the flight was sold out, but it was a first class seat, and so I had, and the other guy didn't show up that would have been sitting next to me. So I had the whole thing to myself, and I was trying to write my amends because I had not made my amends to him. And I was willing to make it, but I just, my mind was racing, and I just couldn't get anything on paper as we were flying up there. And it was so frustrating, and I just couldn't. And so I got there, and I got a cab to the hospital, and I got to the emergency room, and he was in the emergency, and they had been there a little bit, and there were all these people around him and all working on him and stuff, and so I asked. If he was, I asked his wife if he was awake, and she says no, that he hasn't been conscious ever since he passed out, and so I looked over, and all of a sudden, all these people that were around the bed all moved to the other side of the room, and basically, I guess what it was the emergency room people were handing off my brother to the ICU people. And so they were kind of coordinating. And so there was only one nurse over there by him. And so I went over there, and I asked her if he could hear me. And she said, "Well, we don't know, but we think that he probably can." And so anyway, and I made an amends, and I cannot tell you today. I've tried to remember it. I don't know what I said. But he was laying with his head off to one side, and a tear formed and rolled out of the bridge of his nose. And I knew that he heard me. And I had somebody from this program point out later on that not only was that my amends to him, that was his amends to me. And it was a sign of forgiveness. And what peace came from that. And so he was in the hospital for 3 days up there, and his wife brought up that pastor that sat next to me at that step study, the priest. And he was up there for the 3 days that I was up there until my brother passed away. And so here I had nobody else knew he was in program, and some people knew I was in program, but they didn't know there was that connection between the two of us. But that I had this personal OA person with me at this very, very difficult time. And and as I look back on that I saw what amazing lengths our higher power will go to when we ask him, when we invite him in. And I look back, and I still see it as almost like the grand finale of a fireworks show that I got to really just get engulfed with this program, and to see that my higher power was there, and he was calling the shots, that all I had to do was show up one day at a time, and that was it. And so I ended up making the amends that I had to. His wife did not like me, and I didn't like her. That's why I owed her an amends. That she was his second wife, and she was mean. And so I had done something that really infuriated her. I had sent she didn't like his son, my nephew, from his first marriage, and she didn't have him come up to Stanford to be with his dad or to visit his dad at this time. And so I called one of my sons and I said, "You get Joey on a plane and get him up here." And so I did. And so when she saw he was there, she was just furious. And you know how the hospitals have these swinging doors with little windows? I can see her coming like a linebacker. And she's coming down, and I said, "Uh-oh, this is it." And all of a sudden, I just got this notion, now's the time for the amends. And the one thing that I've learned about this program, that when God says to do something, you do it. And so she comes barging through the door, and I said, "Lana," I said, "I really owe you an amends." And she says, "For what?" And I said, "Well, for not welcoming you to the family and not really accepting you and your two kids into the family the way I should have." And then that was true. That was true. And she said, "Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that." And yeah, I think that was the last time she was nice to us. That she ended up suing us after he died. And we had all it was a court battle that went on for probably 3 years. The weird part was that me having made my amend, I was totally free of this of the drama that when we would go into these different settings to where we would have to interact, that I was totally free to interact. It was almost like I was bulletproof, that I felt totally comfortable being in her presence, and even though she was still a mean person. And my sister, on the other hand, who is way more spiritual than I am, she was actually a chaplain at a major hospital in Southern California, and she had a heck of a time because she didn't have a 12-step program, and it was really difficult to forgive under those circumstances for her. And for me, I was able to do that, and it was because of this program. It teaches us so many things that books can't teach us. That this is God taking us by the hand and leading us. And I'm going to say step by step because that's exactly what he does, and he leads us step by step through this. This maze that we're in. And if you can really just kind of accept that this is everything is happening the way it's supposed to, then you know that you're on the right track. And that's the other thing reminded me, that the spiritual experience that I had when my brother was actually dying. And I was standing on one side of him, and I was holding his hand, and the priest had done, delivered the last rites and all of that that we have in the in our church, and that he had his hand on his chest, and then he took his hand off his chest and turned and walked away, and then my brother died right there at that moment. And of course I was overcome with grief and I was crying, and all of a sudden I had this tremendous feeling of peace. And what it was that it was a spiritual experience, and I don't know what caused it or what the mechanism was, but it was the feeling that this is the way it's supposed to be. There's nothing wrong here. Yes, your brother just died, but there is nothing wrong here. This is what is supposed to have happened has just happened. And it lasted for maybe a minute at the most. And I had this this feeling of peace that was almost like a the eye of a hurricane or something, that it was just very quiet in that moment inside. And then they became emotional again shortly thereafter. But yeah, during that moment, that it taught me something about death, that this is part of the pro this is part of the process, and that was something that yes, I get to still grieve. My oldest son died in September, and I grieve that even today. And I just in fact my bookmark and my big book is one of his mass cards, and that, and there's a lot of sadness in life, and there's and some of these things that we encounter, but there's also the joy of knowing that we're on a path. If we work these steps to the best of our ability, that we are on a path that's going to take us to places that we have no other way to get to. And that talk about happiness. I've noticed the times when I most happy and have been the most happy is when I have no doubt that I'm doing the will of God. When I know that I'm where I'm supposed to be, doing what I'm supposed to be doing, there's just something about that that is a is indescribable. Those are words that come right out of the promises, that indescribable. Yeah, and that's probably the really the way that it is, that we are so blessed to have this program, and that teaches us a way of living, a way of life that really works. And okay, so I think I'm through with eight. And, oh no, I the one thing I want to talk about amends, that there are several kinds of amends that I encountered. One was the direct amends, the face-to-face amends. Another one was the indirect, write a letter to somebody who is deceased that you need to make an amends to. So I've gotten to do that, and then one that I have not done personally was the empty chair amends, is to pretend, for example, your mom is in the empty chair and you're talking to her, and your sponsor's there with you during this process, and you can make amends in a way that is verbal, and so that's that was one that another one. And of course the living amends was incredibly important for me, because this was my second marriage, my marriage today, and so we've been married 30 years now, and so our kids have grown. We have two children from this marriage, but I have five children from my first marriage. And the and when I went to make amends to them, I realized that one of the amends that I owed them was for ruining Christmas one year. That here they had been looking forward to Christmas, these five little guys, and I had a hearing with the workman's compensation, and we had somebody that was saying that we were, had caused him damage, and he was suing us and all this kind of stuff, unbelievably, but it was on Christmas Eve. And so I go to this hearing on Christmas Eve, and the judge just kicks our butt, so we lose the hearing. And so that didn't make me feel too good, and I came home and I sulked the whole Christmas holiday, and I realized that I basically ruined it for the kids. And so part of my living amends was as my kids from my second marriage were growing up, even though I'd made the amends over there, that if I were to let other things take priority during the Christmas holidays over them and family and that, I'd be doing the same thing that I did in the in my first marriage, and the amends would be meaningless. You know, it doesn't matter what I told my first family. If I went and did it again with my second family, what kind of an amends is that? And so that I've you know, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Polar Express, but basically the gist of the movie is that if you can still hear the bell ringing and the well, the Santa Claus bell, and if you can still hear it ring, well, then you still have the Christmas spirit. Well, I can still hear it ring, and I look back at all of the richness that I've been able to build up memories with that I would not have if all I thought about was food, where I'm going to get the next meal, where can I pull off a binge where nobody's going to interrupt me. If that had been the focus of the rest of my life, I would be a pretty sad guy today. And that, you know, thank God that 30 some odd years ago, that I was led to Overeaters Anonymous. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Daryl. Thank you. Does anyone in the gallery have a question for Daryl?
I do.
Okay, go ahead, Georgia.
I have a situation with a daughter-in-law that I don't know. Well, I want to say I don't know what happened. I have a pretty good idea, but she won't take my texts. She won't take my phone calls. And I feel like my only recourse is to write her the letter because I haven't been invited to their house in quite a while. And I would like to make an amends to her. Do you think that's okay to write her a letter?
Well, do you owe her an amends to start with? I mean, is that
I think I do.
okay? So you think there's something that you did that is causing the situation? Yeah, if she's not willing to talk to you face to face, then a letter would certainly work, and I would say in the letter to be sure to let her know that the avenue to talk to you about whatever there is between the two of you that needs to get resolved is you know, all she has to do is call, and maybe we can meet for lunch, or we could talk about it or whatever. But you know, I would say have an invitation to an actual face-to-face meeting with her. But if she doesn't, remember the book just told us tonight that our job is to clean off our side of the street. We don't have to clean off their side of the street. She can have all the resentment she wants, but if once you've cleaned off your side of the street, you're done.